Hello, I'm your host, Erin Gruwell, and welcome to the Freedom Writers Podcast. Today's show is episode number 55, featuring my candid conversation with Noray Garibian. Noray and I discussed the horrific Armenian genocide and the effect it still has on millions of Armenians living around the world 105 years later. We also discuss how the Armenian diaspora worked to support sovereignty, education, and recognition, while sadly, many countries still do not acknowledge the Armenian genocide. Our conversation is powerful and thought-provoking, and I hope it will leave you feeling enlightened and empowered to make a difference. From the moment that my student Carlos raised his hand and asked, "What is the Holocaust?" the Freedom Writers and I have used powerful stories from history to inform not only our lives, but the lives of the students we interact with daily. Since the very first episode of our podcast, where we interviewed a Holocaust survivor, we have shared stories from other survivors as well. These stories of the Holocaust and the Cambodian, Rwandan, and Bosnian genocides are real, raw, and relevant, but are not the full story of man's inhumanity. Today's guest, Noray, was born in the Soviet Republic of Armenia and considers herself to be a different type of survivor. Unlike our previous guests, whose traumatic experiences are recognized around the world as a genocide, Noray's truth is sadly still in dispute. At the time of this episode's recording, only 32 countries have officially recognized the Armenian genocide or condemned its offender, the Ottoman Empire. In fact, this week marks just 1 year since the U.S. House of Representatives officially recognized the Armenian genocide. Even after receiving another affirmation from the U.S. Senate, the genocide remains ignored by the White House. For many Armenians, like Noray, this lack of recognition from the international community has been frustrating. Turkey, the successor state of the Ottoman Empire, is a notable holdout, which has led to tension and turmoil in the region. To further complicate the situation, there is now an increase in violence between Armenia and neighboring Azerbaijan. While it is easy to see this complex issue as binary, I think it is important to remember that overgeneralization ignores the humanity that lies on both sides. Our first podcast guest, Renee Firestone, an Auschwitz survivor, told the Freedom Writers, "It's important to remember that not all Germans were Nazis. It was the Nazis who committed the Holocaust, not every German." Regardless of your political leanings, I hope you are able to hear the pain and anguish in Noray's narrative and stand beside her in her fight for present-day peace and recognition for the Armenian genocide. Without further ado, here is my courageous conversation with Noray Garibian. One of my fondest memories was with our guest sitting on a stage, speaking to Freedom Writer teachers from around the globe, especially a delegation sent by the U.S. State Department from Israel and the Palestinian territories. And on that stage were Freedom Writer teachers who have deep roots to activism and advocacy, speaking on things that hit deep. One of those speakers was a Cambodian refugee who happened to be a Freedom Writer. Another speaker on that stage was a Rwandan survivor from the genocide in Rwanda. We had a phenomenal Freedom Writer teacher who survived apartheid in South Africa. And our incredible next guest, who brought to life the Armenian genocide to each and every one of those scholars, educators, and freedom writers. And we were rapt. We were rapt with her poetry and her beautiful words, bringing history to life. And what a lot of teachers walked away with was the sense of, why wasn't I taught that when I was in school? Why isn't the Armenian genocide a part of our textbooks? And how can we know more and do more? So today is very telling because today is about learning, about educating ourselves, and then a call to action to do And so I'm so excited that our guest today is not only a freedom writer teacher, but she truly is an activist, and we need activism today more than ever. So please say hello to our guest in 70 countries or more, Nare.
Thank you for having me today. I really appreciate this opportunity to share my story.
And I love that it's your story. There's such a beauty of knowing your roots, knowing your homeland, and understanding how your family came to Glendale. We are at your college. I'm yes. Proudly wearing your shirt today for Glendale Community College. But I love that part of the Armenian diaspora, that Glendale, California is one of the largest epicenters of the Armenian population here in Southern California, as well as around the world. Mm-hmm. So were you born and raised in this here city?
Well, I appreciate you wearing GCC colors. It's very thankful for that. It means a lot. I was actually born in the Soviet Union, in Armenia. And as the Soviet Union began to crumble, our family decided to immigrate to Glendale, California. Some of our family members were already here. And so it was, in a sense, my ancestors survived genocide, escaped, and came to Armenia. And then now there's the Soviet Union and its issues and its repression. So then our family decided to move again, this time to America. So I'm very thankful for what I've received in America, what I've learned, the education I've received, the somewhat comfortable life I've lived. Even though we lived in America and grew up in America, our grandparents spoke Armenian only, and so we would speak with them in Armenian and therefore maintain our language. We also had the opportunity to be part of a youth group where we learned about Armenian history, because the Soviet Union didn't really espouse learning your own history. So a lot of Armenian history wasn't really taught to our parents correctly. I think being here is important. It's good that I'm in America because I can help my people and continue to fight for justice as the Armenian genocide is not recognized.
What I'd love to do throughout this podcast is to really go backwards into some of those mysteries of history. Mm-hmm. Often they say that people who write the history books mm-hmm. are those who win the wars.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And unfortunately, that overlooks the truth. And as a teacher of history, I'm so intrigued by looking at man's inhumanity so that we can learn to be mm-hmm. more humane. So let's go backwards. For all of those sure. students in classrooms who don't have a map in front of them, one of the things that you did so beautifully and poetically in your book of poems was to look at the map of Armenia and to write an exquisite poem that explains your country. So to begin with, would you read that incredible poem? So as you were reading the face of a woman, our listeners can envision the map of Armenia.
Sure. So the map of Armenia is shaped in a woman's profile. And I understood her to be a person, an actual person outlined as a country, Armenia. Lover, Nare Garibian. Land of my fathers, land of my birth. I comb through tangled strands of hair, lie on your neck, engulfed by warm breath. Swim through your rivers, reaching a rocky chin. Climbing your shore, my feet sink into sand. Resurfacing rolling hills, swaying crimson poppies, open to speak of dreams. Tears disappear into wrinkled ruins. The curves of Mount Ararat poke the sky. Oval-shaped stars gaze, birds fly in circles under an arching horizon, stopping to hear her.
I love that you're in academia. I love that you write books and poems and continue to enlighten people. So here at Glendale Community College, I understand that the community has about 200,000 Armenian residents. How many students at the community college are of Armenian descent?
I don't have exact numbers, but I would say definitely more than half is of Armenian descent. Including faculty, staff, administrator. And it's a pretty good majority on campus. And so speaking about these issues, such as the Armenian genocide and other injustices, we sort of have this community already. So it's a little bit easier to express. Even non-Armenian faculty know the story and can help you and can support you. So I think being in GCC and in this community, it's easier to sort of tell people about dark things. And the important thing for our advocacy is that we want non-Armenians to also understand in other cities and other states the severity of, you know, injustices not being recognized.
Absolutely. For those that are familiar with our story, there was a moment where a student named Carlos raised his hand and said, "What is that? What is the Holocaust?" And what I realized at that moment is that for a lot of students, they're very insular, mm-hmm. and they don't have context of the complexities of other cultures and creeds. And so I realized at that moment that even though none of my students were Jewish, that I needed to start teaching about other people's history mm-hmm. for them to know their own. So I love that for our listeners, they are going to get some great historical insight of your homeland. So you just read this great poem mm-hmm. where she is the profile of a woman, and that profile of a woman is tucked into the Caucasus. So can you tell our listeners what surrounds your country?
Current day Armenia as it is existing today, is located in between Russia, Georgia, Azerbaijan, and Turkey. And of course, Iran is on the southern border. So we are a landlocked country. We love our history. We love our people. Whenever I visit Armenia, I've visited Armenia at least 8 or 9 times since I immigrated to America. And every time you set your foot on Armenian land, Armenia, or even Artsakh, which we will talk about, I feel like you're at home. I feel at home, as if, you know, the call of the land is really not made up. It's not a made up thing. I think for any indigenous people or, you know, someone's hometown, you potentially could have that same feeling of, you know, stepping on your birth land, and you get a weird sense of you feel something that is very hard to describe. And of course, current day Armenia is what is left after the genocide. So that's why current Armenia is so important to us. It's the only bit of homeland we have remaining. I've seen what it means when, for example, a country like Turkey, the Ottoman Empire, perpetrates genocide. You see the aftermath. I've seen it with my own eyes, and I've written a book about that as well. So I feel like we've seen what inhumanity does. And that's why it's so important to protect what we have left.
What I have come to appreciate for the Freedom Riders is when we learned about other cultures, there was the sense that we have to go. And Freedom Riders have been to Poland and gone to concentration camps in Poland in homage of the Holocaust survivors they befriended. They went throughout Bosnia-Herzegovina and Croatia during the Balkan genocide. I'd like to use the word genocide mm-hmm. because I appreciate that you continue to use it. Mm-hmm. Can we talk about why would other countries be resistant, including the United States of America? Why will they not embrace these atrocities as a war crime against humanity and call it a genocide?
Well, I would say it's been 105 years since the genocide occurred. And I feel like because it wasn't properly recognized during that time, we're speaking about 1915, it started and ended about 1921. During that time, there were trials to bring the perpetrators to justice. However, the perpetrators had already left to Europe. And since the genocide occurred, that denial has been festering. It's been growing. It's like you water a plant and it, you know, blooms and it's green. But imagine watering hatred and denial and what that produces. Because of that denial and not proper recognition and acknowledgement that it was the genocide, the Armenian genocide, it's easy for people to forget. And potentially, if the Armenian genocide was properly recognized, other genocides might not have occurred. And Raphael Lemkin actually coined the word genocide based on the Armenian experience when the Holocaust was taking place. So that's why I feel like other countries don't feel the urgency or the need to acknowledge it as the Armenian genocide, because there's money involved, you know, there's oil involved. Potentially, that might be one of the reasons why people don't want to admit. And when the main perpetrator country doesn't recognize their own wrongdoing, they don't let their own people in Turkey come to terms with what happened, and the hatred keeps growing.
I think it's important for our young listeners who don't have as much context as you to understand this special little country has such great history in a region that has fought wars over religion. And so Armenia was the first country that adopted Christianity in 301 AD. So you have monasteries and cathedrals that go through each and every era and age. And what is it like when you go back to Armenia and you see some of these grand monasteries and cathedrals that have been destroyed in the wars that have been fought throughout the ages?
So when we look at Turkey and the remaining churches that are still there in ruins, it gives you even more urgency to know that, you know, the same thing could happen to Armenian churches if we don't defend our country. Armenia is a place of education, millennia old. In Artsakh, which is another Armenian section in the Southern Caucasus, they have monasteries that are 4th century old, you know, and even in Turkey, there are old monasteries that were part of the Silk Road. It's a place of culture, art, conversation, food, hospitality, peacefulness. And so I feel anyone can really understand that. So I hope those are some of the common elements people can see in culture or each other's stories. I think that's why Armenia is such a special place.
So in this landlocked region surrounded by Georgia and Russia and Turkey, Azerbaijan and Iran, when the genocide began in World War I with the Ottoman Empire, historians speculate that between 1 and 1.5 million people were perished, slaughtered, mm-hmm. murdered. And so when you think about 1.5 million right now in Armenia, the estimated population is about 3 million. So what does that do to you as an Armenian to realize that 1.5 million people lost their lives because of how they live and love and practice?
It's very heartbreaking, but at the same time, we are survivors. So I'm a descendant of Armenian genocide survivors. And I feel even it is a very heartbreaking fact, but sadly enough, even out of that, there's a survival that you learn. It's sort of you're born with it. It's part of you. And the unfortunate way the genocide occurred was the first night on April 24, they gathered all the thinkers, all the leaders of the community. And when you know, kill off leaders of a community, the people can get lost. And so first, that's what the Ottoman Empire did was, you know, kill all these leaders and thinkers that could have led their people to maybe defend or to maybe find other ways of surviving. And so, you know, the thinkers and leaders are really important in a community. The sad reality is that we're indigenous people on Armenian and Artsakh land. It's been Armenia for a very long time, for millennia. And, you know, for other countries to then feel the need to, oh, we have to, you know, conquer Artsakh or we have to conquer Armenia. So, but personally, I feel devastated. I feel sad. I feel, you know, just it's become a part of us. It's like, it's not something we can avoid. It's something that's just a part of us. And it sort of becomes this normal thing. It's weird. It becomes normal in the sense that I know I'm a survivor and I know I have to keep defending the Armenian genocide occurrence.
I'm glad you said survivor, because when we assembled survivors mm-hmm. to be on that panel, that kinship that you all felt. It was like you had your own unspoken language. And for those of us watching, it was very voyeuristic. But those of you on the stage, I remember Trezor, who's from Rwanda, breaking down and crying. And all of you rallied around him and had this the subtlety of a glance and a hug. And when Rauru got very emotional about his experience in Cambodia, and then as with you. And so I think there's something to be said about survivor culture. It's this inner strength. That inner strength brought your father home. I understand your father is an acclaimed musician, a proud Armenian, and he left Armenia to come to America, and then the call of his homeland brought him back as an intellectual, as an artist, and most incredibly a musician. What was that like when your father decided to go back to Armenia and to create a school?
In 1994, the current struggle that people see on the news, in 1994, Artsakh, which is again a millennia-old Armenian country, gained independence from Azerbaijan. And during the Soviet Union, Artsakh was given to Azerbaijan by Stalin. So when in 1994, the Artsakh Armenians and diasporan Armenians fought together to gain independence, he decided to go back to Artsakh, and there was already a bombarded, sort of dilapidated school there. And basically, I remember as a kid that while in America, we would do everything for that school. We would type up documents. We would do fundraisers. Every concert he did in America, the proceeds went to the school. He is also an artist, and he had art shows, and every proceed from selling a painting would go to the school. And it was like our family project or our family calling, you would say. And so he went there and he gained sponsors from America. It's based on sponsorship and volunteerism. It's actually even an academy. It's sort of an academic music academy. And in 1997, the school opened with an official ceremony. 10 years later, they have their first graduates. They've won international awards for music. And in Artsakh, after the independence war, it was really in shambles. I mean, there was no electricity, no water. We even like fundraised and got plumbing from America to go there. So for him, he became totally dedicated to the school. He decided he's going to live there permanently. So he, you know, left America to live in Artsakh, and he's been there ever since. Yeah, like the other day, I accidentally got a call from him unexpectedly, because currently in the current Artsakh struggle, there's no phones or electricity. So I got like a surprise call yesterday from Viber. I'm like, I don't know who this person is. And it turns out it's my dad who was able to come to Yerevan for a few days and has a phone. So a part of me is, he's a big humanitarian person and he's done so much for those children. But now the school is closed. Music is not really heard in those halls right now. But he's very hopeful that the current conflict with Azerbaijan and Turkey and Artsakh will end peacefully.
So as a daughter and a survivor, this is so real because your father is currently in the epicenter where they are dropping cluster bombs. Your father is in the epicenter where Turkish-funded F-16 bombers are flying overhead, and drones, and mercenaries. So as a daughter, let's talk about what that feels
sure.
like, that your father went back to create. There's something so beautiful about art. You are an artist, a poet, and an author, and your father creates art with his music. So the silencing of that music metaphorically is so sad. And figuratively, it is just devastating that the music he created in the halls is now drones flying above, the screaming of civilians. Because I understand 60 civilians have lost their life since the conflict has begun. So what is that like for you every single morning thinking about your father?
So Azerbaijan's first attack happened September 27 on a Sunday. I heard in the news that such an attack occurred. My first instinct was to email my dad because I wasn't sure if he would have a phone. So like almost frantically, I'm trying to figure out maybe I should write him an email to confirm, like, how is he? What's happening? Then I had just downloaded the Armenian font on my phone because we do write in English, but I was like, I had an urgency to write it in Armenian. And so the day before, I had downloaded the Armenian font on my phone. So I frantically somehow felt I had to say it in Armenian. So I wrote him an email in Armenian. How are you? Is it true? You know, is there attack? What's happening? And then he wrote back saying, yes, indeed, Azerbaijan has attacked Artsakh and that he's okay. They have bunkers or they have underground, I guess, basements you can call where, you know, where you hear they have sirens too. So when they the sirens are heard, they go into bunkers or underground basements, like I would say. But sometimes, like since September 27, the bombardment has been so constant that they haven't even had a chance to turn on sirens. So like at one point I was really worried, but then when he answered, he says, I'm okay, we will be okay. I mean, every time I ask him that question, that's what he says. We will be okay. It will be okay. And so does he say that to me so I won't worry? Does he say that because he truly believes it. Many Armenians everywhere, globally, 7 million Armenian diaspora believes it. Because it's a, you know, it's a self-determination issue. It's territorial sovereignty. But on a personal note, it's very hard to balance the personal with what's happening out in Artsakh, because that is also personal to me. It's not that just my dad is there and I'm worried about him, but at the same time, my people as a whole, what's happening right now in Artsakh is also personal. So we are very worried. And every time we see like lists of soldiers who have died during the struggle, a part of us like dies too. So I feel it's all personal. At first, like I think as a survivor, you don't have time for tears because you can't waste your energy on that. You have to find ways to cope and spread awareness. So the Armenian diaspora sort of becomes an army too.
Well, I love in this army of the 7 to 8 million diaspora that just this weekend, you and 100 to 150,000 people are estimated to have rallied in downtown Beverly Hills outside of the Turkish consulate. It was peaceful. It was beautiful. There was this camaraderie. And so for those that believe in peaceful protesting, for those that believe in having a voice be spread to the voiceless, what was that like to come together? And I realized it was Armenians and your neighbors who were Muslim and Jewish and Christian and atheist coming together peacefully to protest what's happening. What was that like to see all those different faces and shapes and sizes coming together?
It was really a testament to what Armenia and Artsakh want. They want peace. All Armenians want peace. And so it was nice to come together and it was nice to see that. And we had no doubts that that's the group we're going to have because Armenia is really an Artsakh. Armenia and Artsakh are very important. They're our existence. It's basically a fight for existence, really, because if we don't fight against Azerbaijan, Turkey, American tax dollars that unfortunately fund Azerbaijan and Turkish military aid. Another sad part is that Israel is providing weapons, the drones, the military grade drones that are being used. For me, it's very painful for a people, at least the government of Israel knows, the people know of the Holocaust. They've gone through the Holocaust. They have stories of their own. It's very painful that a country that has felt that and they have the similar experience and the government would say, we don't have enough evidence to stop selling drones to Azerbaijan. You know, that's very painful. And so doing a protest like that does create some peaceful vibes, peaceful camaraderie, because that's what we want. We want peace. From 94 to now, Artsakh and Armenia finally got on their feet. You know, diasporan money, diasporan help, Armenia helped. There's a lot of people, philanthropists. And so over the years, Artsakh and Armenia were rebuilt. Churches were rebuilt, cultural centers were created. And now in Artsakh, all of those have been attacked by drones and, you know, F-16s and other warplanes. And it's basically a 3 million people fighting about 10 million who also have hired now jihadist mercenaries to join the fight. And so protests like that are very important. It's a way of giving awareness. I mean, in the diaspora, we're really suffering. Since it happened on September 27, we're always trying to figure out something to do. What can we do? How can we help? We've collected millions of dollars. We've spread awareness because Twitter is now an issue. Social media is also a battle. A lot of fake information is provided by Azerbaijan. And so I think 150,000 people coming together and peacefully expressing their hurt and their demands for maybe U.S. sanctioning Azerbaijan and Turkey from funding the military. It just, it's part of us. It's a survivor thing. It's a part of us. We have to stand up and speak because we know what happens when people don't.
What I have enjoyed watching here in Los Angeles over the years is that sense of peaceful protesting for recognition. I know with the 100th anniversary of the genocide, there's been a call to action in this community. And I love that April 24th has become a day of the martyr, a day to recognize the Armenian genocide. What does that feel like when you fight and fight and fight and fight some more?
It's just part of you. I mean, I don't think you can choose it. I don't think you can deny it, that's what you have to do. In the U.S., many states have also passed resolutions that they recognize what's happened. But I think the most important country to recognize it is Turkey, and to take ownership and to figure out a way to heal. But when 105 years pass and recognition isn't there, then what happens to the people who are denying it? And so is there an opportunity for healing? I cannot answer that, because if the perpetrator is not owning up to it and finding ways to, I don't know if you can restore anything, you can't restore life, but find a way, something to at least help your people heal. Because like even in Azerbaijan, there was Armenian pogroms, there were slogans like hate Armenians, hatred towards Armenians. You know, there was rallies in Baku and Sumgait telling Azeris to kill their Armenian neighbors in the 1980s. And so that's why Armenia has to fight, because we know what the outcome can be. That fear is there. We know what Turkey and Azerbaijan, with their hatred, are capable of doing.
I think that going back to that beautiful panel that you were on, I think that when folks were talking about this pure segregation and Trezor evoked the Hutu government on sanctioned radios calling the Tutsis cockroaches, when Rauru talked about the killing fields in Cambodia, that when you see that kind of hatred, when it is state-sanctioned or it is allowed. So with your father being in his homeland, has he heard the hatred? Has he seen the hatred?
I feel a lot of the hatred is being exposed in social media. Azerbaijan has paid, you know, for fake news and comments to come out in social media. So I think a lot of those hatred slogans are not happening on the streets necessarily anymore. However, in Azerbaijan, there are protests. There are two kinds of protests in Azerbaijan. There's the larger protest, pro-Azerbaijan, pro-killing people. And then there's a smaller minority protest of it's enough. But because Azerbaijan lives in hatred and espouses hatred, clearly the first half is going to get the attention, hatred and killing.
Can there be a negotiation? I know that historically, when Armenia declared first its independence in 1991 in September, it wasn't actually recognized until December when the Soviet Union fell. So from the actual independence to the 1994 conflict, has there been talk of how could we negotiate? How could we have a peaceful transfer of power? And is that possible going forward?
I think the issue is that even though Artsakh is on millennia-old indigenous land and Armenians have always lived there, they've always been there. However, the international community doesn't recognize Artsakh as an autonomous state. 82% of people, Armenian people in Artsakh, in the voted to give Artsakh autonomy during the first struggle in the 80s and 90s. I don't think you need like legal documents to provide self-determination. But because Artsakh isn't fully recognized by the international community, it's not given the agency to decide what is good for Artsakh. But I know that the Armenian or Artsakh solution is just recognize Artsakh because it's rightfully the land of the Armenian people. However, will Azerbaijan and Turkey respect other countries who have recognized Artsakh or potentially can recognize Artsakh? That's the fear, is their hatred is so driven, it's so palpable. Azerbaijan didn't even follow the ceasefire that was agreed upon on October 10th. So the fear is, would Turkey and Azerbaijan respect that? Clearly right now they're not respecting humanity and rules of humanity and rules of warfare. If the perpetrators still haven't taken ownership, then how does that solution then stay? So that's the fear, I think, for many people.
I love that you read a poem describing the profile of Armenia. Mm-hmm. Is there a special poem from one of your books that could shed light on either the power of the people or even the travesties of the genocide?
I have from the book called When Ruins Speak. This was based on the trip, not really trip, but the journey, really the life journey I took to Eastern Turkey, which is referred to as Western Armenia, where the Armenian villages were before the genocide. There's two of them, but this first one I think is really important because it's about an Armenian family who stayed in their ancestral home, even though the genocide was happening around them. So when we were going on our travels in Eastern Turkey, there's no Armenians, first of all. And second of all, it's mostly Kurdish people living in those areas. And so everywhere we went, we didn't see really Armenian people. But when we came to this man's house in a region called Arapkir, we saw an Armenian family living there in a place that no Armenian should be living there because of the genocide. The coffee cup, the lion, and the lioness. Over there, down in Arapkir Valley, amongst a grove of poplars, sits the lair you seek, replies an elderly man perched on a wooden stool, eyes drawn down, sipping dark, thick, black coffee from a miniature porcelain cup, hardly visible in his rough, large hand. His fingers slowly unravel in succession, exposing the hidden vessel. Cylindrical, 2 inches in height, a curved handle tucked underneath the rim. My cup warned of your coming, the man points to the image inside, a faint human silhouette walking along a path, outlined by loosely clustered coffee grains. I follow the man, directed by the coffee cup, uncertain of the lair's existence. Here we are. Look at the end of the road. This is your journey. Trust fate's expression, sketched along the porcelain. I begin to walk upon the graveled dirt path, in search of a lair, rocky edges, shadowy outlines, unfathomable depths. But such a place does not surface. Instead, a 3-story house with a wooden, yellow-pleated door greets me, with handles of intricate ironwork. Slowly, I venture forth, opening the door. Delighted and afraid, I climb the evenly spaced stairs. Handcrafted ceiling logs loom above me. An arched doorway welcomes me with open arms. Ove, ove, hametsek. Who is it? Who is it? Come in, beckons a voice from within. Deep and powerful, like a lion's roar. Entering the room, I come face to face with a man and a woman, a lion and a lioness, a commanding brow lined with age, deep-set eyes, chiseled jawline, a sophisticated mustache upon Broad's shoulders. He awaits a dialogue with me. Steady eyes pierce ahead, under dark, defined eyebrows, above softly curved cheekbones. Lips ajar, she is impatient to speak of life in Arabkir. I sit in their living room, unable to react. I want to simultaneously weep, laugh, and kneel upon my knees. I can only stare at a tapestry hanging from the wall. It is rectangular, with fringes, a background of bold orange sky, bold green grass. And at center, a lion stands firm, alert and unflinching, with the lioness at his side. Neck elongated, eyes aglare, paws encircling her cubs. Suddenly, I understand. I have found the lair where a man and a woman reside. My ancestors on ancestral land. Stepping back onto the gravel dirt road, I ask Sarkis, how did you stay when we were endangered? How did you avoid extinction? With a lion's roar, he answers, Havatk, faith.
I want to read your foreword.
Oh, please.
For my ancestors, in remembrance of days lived and days left untouched, in the hope of new generations to reconnect with their roots and create a meaningful tomorrow. What does a meaningful tomorrow mean to you today?
Yeah, when I wrote that, I didn't picture the genocide continuing, really. And so these words mean more to me than before. Because now in my lifetime, I'm seeing the genocide happen. I didn't ever imagine my lifetime to see that. And this is not just a war for us. It's just our life. Because if something happens to Armenia and Artsakh, then the Armenian diaspora loses its meaning. And so this isn't just, you know, lack of weapons. This isn't just U.S. not supporting or the world powers not listening. It's something that we have to fight for, or else Armenians know what that means, particularly in this situation. And so at this point, I'm not really sure what that meaningful tomorrow is, but I know that we want peace. And, you know, it's not a war. It's really a struggle to protect against the genocide, because clearly the genocide is continuing. If we don't stand up now, or at least spread awareness, you know, tell the Western countries to do something, that would be useful for peace.
If there is a young person who, for the first time, is hearing these terms and wants to seek out a map and see that portrait that you described, or a student who wants to learn more about your ancestry and to read your poems, what would you encourage them to do?
You can go to anca.org, where there's a lot of call for action currently about the current situation in Artsakh and Armenia. Speak to a neighbor if you know that you have an Armenian neighbor or an Armenian friend, and you know you have that resource, ask them questions and maybe see how they're doing, how this impacts them. I would say the most important thing is to be empathetic, to learn from others, see protests in a different light. Like if you see something on TV, don't take it for face value. Dig deeper and see where the true story lies.
I'm so grateful to our guest, Marie Garibian, for bravely sharing her personal story, her family's journey, and her people's plight. My dear listeners, may each of us look for ways to spread goodwill in our chaotic world. May we stand together in the face of evil to fight for peace. And in honor of those lost during the Armenian genocide, may we all use the lessons of history to create a better, more compassionate future. That concludes our show this week. Thank you so much for listening. Once again, I'm your host, Aaron Gruel. This episode was produced and edited by Matt Martin Hall and Rob Falk. Until next time, dear listeners, may you write what needs to be written and tell what needs to be told.